This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.
And there it is. That's as good as it gets on this stage. Nissan Townstar EV strikes again. It's an unstoppable van. Unstoppable!
Look, just fantastic. You can actually see the ProPilot technology in action. Effortless parallel parking.
It moves with all the confidence that comes with a 5-year warranty.
And with a bench full of all-star van experts, there's real strength in depth here.
That's all-star quality.
Search Nissan Townstar EV and visit your local all-star van centre to see for yourself.
Terms and conditions apply. 5 years or 100,000 miles, whichever comes first.
ProPilot is an advanced driver assist technology. Driver's responsibility to stay alert, drive safely, and control vehicle at all times.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly supported by McDelivery, bringing you the food you love. McDelivery brings a top-tier lineup of food right to your door. No matter the result, you'll always be winning with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app and you'll get rewards points delivered too, so that ordering today means some tasty rewards for tomorrow. Only via app at participating restaurants. 18 plus rewards registration required. Points only on menu items, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Although we've only got four games left and they've got 5 games left, that's a long way to go yet at this stage of the season.
So it's all to play for still?
I think so. Do you want to bet against us?
I have every confidence it'll be a wonderful day for the supporters. Obviously, it'll put the icing on the cake for them if we get the right result. But I think Saturday will put in a nutshell everything that's gone on at this club, on and off the field over the last few years anyway, trying to achieve things and produce things for those people that matter, who are the supporters.
Did you feel that you were not allowed to be the manager anymore?
Things were beginning to look that way, yes.
You used a phrase that was quoted in the papers where you said that you felt like an office boy.
No, I didn't. I said if I'm getting paid as a manager, I expect to be able to manage, not to be an office boy.
Last May, you won the league title for Aston Villa and were named Manager of the Year. Has what's happened today made you wonder about the state of football?
No different to what I was thinking yesterday or last week. The state of football is a little bit serious at the moment, and there's a lot of things going to be done. But I'm in the football, I'm unemployed at the moment, and I'll just have a rest, and then we'll see whether we come back in football or whether we come back into some of the business.
Now a week since Ron Saunders resigned as manager of the league champions, and although he looks set to take charge of their arch-rivals Birmingham City, the Villa fans still want him back. The Aston Villa Democracy Group has been formed, and tonight before the game with Spurs, they were out in force. Protest leaflets were snapped up, and there was no shortage of signatures on petitions demanding the return of Saunders. But aren't they wasting their time? Protest leader Butchin.
No. As far as when I spoke to Ron Saunders this afternoon, he had not as then signed for Birmingham. Therefore, even at this 11th hour, we can still at least try to show Ron Saunders the feeling of the Aston Villa supporters, who are the real people of the club.
When I go home late at night, this is a song that I really like to sing right now, so I'll play it for you. It's called My Old Man.
Jamie Vardy, and he gets his second and puts the issue beyond doubt.
Welcome to the My Old Man Said podcast. I'm David Michael, the editor of MyOldManSaid.com, and joining me as co-host as we dissect, well, what is becoming, I think it's the start, isn't it, Chris, of another Villa meltdown, or a Villa fan meltdown. It's beginning.
It could well be. I think we're teetering, as they say.
The honeymoon period of celebrating the mercurial Dean Smith and Grealish now starts to take a more realistic tone as we head in towards the Christmas period, needing wins.
We need to turn the ship round.
But we'll get into that later on and give a bit more context to why it's not DEFCON 1 just yet. Before we crack on with the show, first of all, obviously there was the sad news of Ron Saunders passing, aged 87. Villa's pretty much most successful manager ever, and a real light of what could have been, I think, because he'd built potentially a legacy which could have rolled on for a good few more seasons. So Villa, before the game at Leicester, there was a minute's applause. What did you think of the tribute?
A strange one. It was, I mean, it's hard because obviously the news broke, didn't it, sort of later on Saturday evening, so it would have been difficult to turn something round super fast. Yeah, it's not like they had 2-3 days or a week's notice. The strange one was actually in the ground, the referee was meant to signal with his whistle the minute's applause. People had already been applauding while the guy spoke on the tannoy and had stuff on the video walls. But the ref blew his whistle to supposedly be the start, and the Leicester players just sort of walked off to the touchline to drop their jackets over there, and everyone was like, oh, so we're not doing this then. It was all a bit of a, it kind of summed up the game really. It was all a bit of a shit show.
That's one of those things where then fans get on social media and start slagging off the Leicester players, but then you think, well, maybe it hasn't been communicated very well at the start.
And I think a minute's applause is, it's a nice way of doing it, but at least with a minute silent, it's a much more defined thing, isn't it? You know that, right, we will start this minute of silence when everyone's relatively quiet and on the whistle, and then it ends on the whistle. It's a little bit easier to implement.
Yeah, I think a minute silence is more dignified, but I think the reason why clubs favour the applause is because obviously in the silence you've got the away fans there, and that won't necessarily honour the silence. So then it becomes a bit of a situation where it's an easier one to do with the applause, because you know it's the safest option.
Yeah, and I've always thought that with a minute's applause, it's meant to be a celebratory thing, a celebration of someone's life rather than a mourning their loss. So it depends where you sort of frame that.
But in terms of Ron Saunders, I mean, he was my first Aston Villa manager. And I mean, the first shock for me as a Villa fan was when he obviously left the club.
I mean, he got the feeling quite quickly, didn't he? He knew what was coming when Ellis was due back, and was probably right, wasn't he?
It was a case of I think he wanted more money. Also, he had this thing about control, and he didn't like people meddling in his affairs. And I mean, I'm just going to play this clip, which is kind of a famous clip, because the season before we'd won the league going toe-to-toe with Ipswich, and their manager at the time was the former England manager Bobby Robson, and he was told about Ron Saunders' resignation during an interview, so he was quite shocked. I'll just play that clip now.
Good grief.
Are you shocked by that?
I'm absolutely shattered. I just cannot. That's right, is it?
Yes.
Well, I can't believe that. That's football, you see. That's how football can change for us and for everyone, really, if you like, where last year he was the manager of the month with a roll-up contract of 3 years, everything really going in his way. Something obviously within the club has gone wrong. He's perhaps, you know, said, look, what's the scene here? And come on, back me up. And I would have thought he hasn't had the backing up. And on, because people don't resign for nothing, you know. Managers of that calibre running those sort of clubs don't resign unless something radically, radically is wrong. It won't be a little small thing. It'll be something which is important to Ron Saunders as a manager, and it's affected his integrity and his dignity. And if, and once that happens to managers, it's rather a sad scene.
It was a big, big surprise at the time, because this is somebody who had brought Villa up from the lower tiers. On the way, you know, they won the League Cup, and then they won a League Cup again. After the 75 one, when they went up, also they won the 1977 one in a marathon against Everton, which ended up with Villa winning it at Old Trafford. I think they were starting to run out of venues for the replays. And then obviously won the league title, which was the crowning glory, first time for a million years that Villa had won the league, and actually made them a force in the present day. Because without Ron Saunders, if we hadn't picked up trophies, I think we would be considered a team like Bolton or Burnley, where you had your glories at the, you know, you were one of the founding members, etc. But
and then faded in the new century.
Yeah,
everything post-war.
I mean, as a kid, you knew that Preston and Burnley and Bolton were, you know, once upon a time, you know, some of the early founding clubs. So they had this real old historical significance. And I think that's where Villa would have been if Ron Saunders didn't give them their present day success. But he was suffering from Alzheimer's in recent years. And I actually bumped into Ronnie Saunders, his son, who looks a bit like Ron Saunders, actually, and I had a good chat with him about the situation. And I was talking about this, an idea of naming the North Stand the Saunders Barton Stand, because with Saunders, you've got this unfinished business where he left. I mean, if you want to boil it down, he walked out on the club, even if, the hierarchy were being a pain in the ass. And so there isn't this completion, because he went off to the Blues straight after. But Barton and him were like hand in hand, because Barton had scouted initially, in his initial capacity with the club, had scouted pretty much every one of those players that became the force of Aston Villa in that period. So, and then obviously he got the European Cup over the line. So there is this, it feels a bit more complete if you call it the Saunders Barton Stand. And, you know, Ronnie Saunders was, you know, he thought it was a good idea. So
it's a strange one, isn't it? Because I suppose if you did what he achieved in the modern era and you walked out on Villa sort of in a Champions League campaign, for example, and then Villa went on to win it, yeah, and then you went on to manage the Blues, you would have all your good work potentially undone, because people would just be like, what the fuck are you doing?
Because when the new owners came into the club, they couldn't understand why Ron Saunders wasn't celebrated so much and why there wasn't already a stand named after him. You know, there's lots of revisionism in his, you know, mediocre players are suddenly celebrated because they interact with fans on, you know, social media or whatever. People that were at one time scapegoats are suddenly legends, and it's kind of bizarre how it works. But at that time, you know, there was a bit of, it wasn't all like, Ron Saunders wasn't the kind of superhero as history will make people out in terms of fans' feelings. Because he was, he didn't suffer fools, you know, he didn't do a lot of press. I mean, he was a decent man on the inner circle, but, you know, when you've got the media fluttering around, anybody with half a sense who doesn't want to waste their time and, you know, with idiots will come across as being a bit of a pain in the ass, when realistically they're just, you know, self-preservation.
Yeah, he came across very abrasive, didn't he? And I know a lot of the players would sort of say he was a very, very blunt, to say the least. He wasn't sort of, if you compare to sort of the current manager, Dean Smith, who comes across quite a kind person, he was very much the tough love approach, wasn't he, with players?
Yeah, but at the same time had a good heart.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, there's the story Andy Gray has been doing the rounds, where Andy Gray opened a club. And Ron Saunders, you know, asked him about his club, and he said, right, in the upcoming match, you're playing, and if you score a goal in the first half and we're comfortable, I'll sub you off at halftime so we can get on with doing his club launch.
Brilliant.
Which is something I wouldn't have actually expected from Ron Saunders. And Andy Gray scored, and I think they were 3-0 up at halftime, and he said, off you go, good luck.
Mad.
which gives you an insight into, you know, what the guy was really like, rather than this kind of abrasive exterior that was the impression that a lot of people got.
Yeah.
But, you know, you only have to look at Brian Clough, who he was a lot more charismatic, but I think they still had the same, let's say, iron rod approach to getting a team together, which is something I think you need nowadays with, you know, player power as it is.
When they're very much a get the job done type of approach, aren't they? Let's just go out there and win.
But anyway, he was my first manager, and they're still to this day the best manager. And, you know, it niggles that he didn't carry on. And hindsight even looks even worse, because within five seasons we were relegated and Villa just fell apart at the seams. And although we've managed to win a couple of League Cups since and challenged for the league a couple of times, it just hasn't been the same. And there is a big what if. In terms of Villa history, since I've been around, the biggest what if is, what if Ron Saunders had stayed around for another five seasons? Would we have had an Aston Villa legacy like, for example, Manchester United or Liverpool have had?
Would you have built a dynasty?
Yeah, exactly. Right, coming up in the show, Mr. Bird will do a Villa Minute, looking back within a minute of what happened at Villa Park against Leicester. In the 3 points, we will discuss quickly paying for fan engagement, the fact that there's another club teetering on the brink of existence, Macclesfield, the Russian drug ban, which is just popped up in the news, which means that Russia will be banned from the World Cup, but I think there's a technicality which means they can play in the European Championships.
I think they've been banned from the Olympics as well, haven't they? It's like a blanket sporting ban, isn't it?
Yeah. Also, the big main headline topic is Aston Villa. Should we be concerned? And then we'll look at Leicester and all the hot takes from that, whether it's, you know, Vardy versus Wesley. The concern over their discipline and why we got absolutely blitzed on the day. And then there'll be no Scott Hogan touch count, because we'll instead have a second part of the podcast this week, which will be a big collection of the Mad Few group, the listeners of this podcast, question and answers. Right, before we go on, just a quick mention of our sponsor, Beer 52. The offer still continues, where all you have to do is pay the postage of £4.95 and you will be sent the next day a box of 10 beers, craft beers. It's essentially a craft beer club, which you can cancel at any time. So you can get your 10 beers, drink them, and then cancel straight after that. It's not a problem, but it's really worth joining. You can select a light or a mixture of dark and light beers. There's a different theme every month, and you know they are real top quality IPAs and darker beers. So if you enjoy your beer, make sure you take advantage of the offer if you haven't already. Right then, Mr. Bird, I'll count you in. It's time for a Villa Minute. 3, 2, 1.
So Leicester go into the game going for a 9th win on the bounce in all competitions. Both teams start brightly in a very open game. Anwar El Ghazi hits the bar when it's actually easier to score. Mings limps off injured, having started the game very shakily anyway. Vardy finds himself clean through after yet another Villa mistake, this time from Wesley. Round Seaton slips the ball in and it's 1-0. Iheanacho finishes a good move, the neat near post finish from a Maddison cross for 2-0. Villa pull one back just before half time though, in stoppage time with a Grealish snapshot following a bit of penalty box ping pong, so it's game on going into the second half, or so we thought. Tielemans and Maddison sort of begin to dominate the middle of the field while Louise and Akamba and McGinn all go missing for Villa for long periods. Villa start the second half well, but give Johnny Evans a free header from a corner to make it 3-1. Great header, but woeful defending. Villa huff, puff and give Leicester more openings, but concede the fourth when Vardy runs clean through. Villa have a couple of desperate penalty appeals turned down, and once the third went in, never looked like scoring or being in the game. Leicester come out comfortable and very deserved winners to go 6 points clear of Manchester City.
Anything else?
My final note will be a rather shambolic day, summed up by the fact that we couldn't even get the tribute to Ron Saunders done properly.
Oh dear, hopefully this isn't the start of things to come. Right, into the 3 points. Point number one, anybody who follows the football supporters issues, you'll probably have heard about this. The concept of socios, which is what West Ham have signed up for, also Juventus, where it's a monetization of fan engagement. So through cryptocurrency, you buy digital tokens with your real money, and then you can use them to vote for various things, i.e. fan engagement. At your club, West Ham have signed up for this. Juventus have actually run their first poll of fan engagement, and it was on the goal music.
Which is a weird one anyway. I mean, I've always been a hater of goal music. But
so this kind of myth of you actually having a share of you know what the club do, you make the decisions, you can influence the decisions. I mean, goal music and the choice, in the Juventus case, the choices were Blink-182, All the Small Things, Blur, Song 2, House of Pain, Jump Around, POD, Boom. And it's like, well, you know, it's the lowest common denominator songs for that, which pretty much I think all those songs are used for goal music around the world or pre-match warm-ups.
Yeah, especially Song 2.
Yeah, but just the concept of fan engagement should be, your fans should have an influence in the club through real engagement anyway. It shouldn't be something that you would have to pay for. You're already paying as a fan anyway on tickets, merchandise, season tickets.
And the rest.
In fact, and to have the cheek to think, how can we monetize these people even more? How can we really drip them dry as consumers? Well, right, let's give them the myth that they actually have a stake in their club and they actually, you know, have to pay for it. It's, I mean, if you're signing up to schemes like that, it's only the dumb will sign up for that.
It's just all a bit wanky, isn't it? Like, it's kind of like token gesture and needless, but it doesn't necessarily add anything to anything. They're just trying to build something that isn't necessarily there. Like, you should have fan engagement anyway. Like, for example, why would Juventus not have an engaged fan base? They're a dominant football team, and the Italian football supporters notoriously are very influential within their clubs anyway.
Yeah, especially from an ultra base. I mean, yeah, the fact that Juventus would normally pay for their ultras to fly to games, or the top of the, you know, the ultras, the droogies, and now suddenly they're having to pay via cryptocurrency to have a say in things like goal celebration music is a bizarre turnaround of events. I'd be interested to see how that got through in Juventus, because I thought the ultra fan base would have stamped that down.
Maybe it's been done without their
influence,
shall we say.
But yeah, it's just cringy. Fans are, you know, abused as it is by people trying to milk them for every coin, but this idea of they're hardly going to be voting on things like, which player should we buy? Should we buy player A, B, or C? It will just be, you know, tenuous things. So
as I said, it's just a token gesture. It's kind of nothingy.
Yeah, I've actually put it on the agenda for Christian Purslow to see what his opinion of this is, and also another potential future happening in football of facial recognition as well. Right, number two, after Berry disappeared, will Macclesfield go the same way? One of the headlines of the Macclesfield's problems with, you know, players refusing to play because of non-payment is Sol Campbell has declared that he's owed $180,000 by the club, so he's supporting a winding up order, a petition over unpaid tax bills. And, you know, this is something that's been going on for a while, and it's only started to become news. But the thing is, will the media be bored of it because of what happened with Berry? Is it kind of old news now and they've moved on?
Yeah, will it be like another group of players refuse to play a game? I think Macclesfield's game against Crewe the weekend was postponed.
Yeah.
But it's almost, as you said, it's not new information anymore. It's just yet another club.
Another example of there's something wrong with the football pyramid. And well, it's like society as a whole, should I say. It's like the top get richer and the poor get poorer. Macclesfield will now appear before the court again regarding their debts on the 18th of December. So watch this space. Meanwhile, in Russia have been handed a four-year ban from all major sporting events by the World Anti-Doping Agency, WADA. This is point number three. And this is where it gets kind of weird. It means the Russian flag and anthem are not allowed at events like the Tokyo Olympics next year. And also the World Cup in Qatar. But athletes who prove they are untainted by doping will be able to compete under a neutral flag. Now, that means they can't play. Surely Russia can't put out a football team under a neutral flag to play in Qatar. So,
surely not. What, are you going to invade somewhere and play under their flag?
Yeah, the World Cup quarterfinals, it's England versus the neutrals. Despite the ban, though, Russia will be able to compete at Euros 2020. But obviously, St. Petersburg is a host city because European's football governing body, UEFA, is not defined as a major event organisation with regards to rulings on anti-doping breaches. This seems like something they've constructed. Of course, they're a major event organisation. I mean, they put on the Champions League, do they not? They put on the Euros, do they not? I think it's just because it's already set up. St. Petersburg has been dedicated as one of the host cities, and there's, you know, X amount of infrastructure and planning has already gone ahead. So they've probably said, like, before you announce this ban, can we have some kind of technicality? Because, you know, we obviously need them. This is already set up. So it's a bit of a dubious one.
I think this is probably going to be an ongoing story over a few weeks here, because I think that obviously the Russians will get to appeal, and it's whether or not the sanctions sort of put against them either get changed or maybe even made more severe. It looks like there's an outgoing anti-doping, like the head of the anti-doping sort of commissioners. They aren't happy with the decision, essentially saying, well, we've banned them, but then we've got all these like almost like soft allowances, essentially allowing little things to slip through the net as well. It's like, well, if you're going to ban them, you have to ban them, and it has to be a carpet ban rather than, you know, letting them play in the Euros, for example. Yeah. That isn't a deterrent.
The thing is, this has been an ongoing thing for decades now. I mean, going back 80s, even 70s, like the Eastern Bloc, Russia, East Germany, you know, some of their athletes, especially when it came to females, the women's side of things. I mean, just ridiculous physiques because they're all like pumped up, allegedly. And it's something, it's almost like it's a way of life. I mean, you know, there's obviously drugs happening in America and everything, and that seems to be almost like an individual thing where the whole Russian thing is seen as the whole country is doing it.
Well, it's like systematic, isn't it? They do it as a country. It's kind of
as a culture,
and it almost sort of gets turned on its head by the Russians when their reply is, well, we're the victims here.
Yeah,
as if sort of cheating the system is, well, of course we're going to cheat the system, why wouldn't we? It's not our fault. It's kind of, it's a very strange dynamic. And how it plays out sort of politically will be quite interesting as well.
And there's always a thin line now, because there's all these there's kind of all these enhancement and nutrient supplements and whatever. It's what, where do you actually draw the line? Because there is a bit of a grey area in terms of some of the stuff that's taken. But anyway, let's not get bogged down in this. Just before we crack on, I just want to give a big shout out to the My Old Man Said patrons who make this show possible and support true independence. We are doing this off our own back. We don't have any producers or an infrastructure to kind of do this. Without you, we can't carry on. So please do, if you enjoy the show, sign up, and you will also get access to extra shows, which we will probably do different ones if we continue to get more patrons in the new year. So I just want to say a big shout out to the patrons that have joined this week. Daniel Knoll from Switzerland. I actually went to where you live, where you have the bears and you have that lake, which I was very impressed by. People get those waterproof rucksacks and commute to work by just jumping into the lake and going with the tide. And that's Bern in Switzerland. If you haven't been, go and check it out. Cody Holcomb, James Rees, Matt Chapman. And just in case I didn't say thank you very much in the last couple of shows, also Matt Deacon and Sheldon Palmer, thank you very much for signing up and being a patron. You can also sign up as a Facebook supporter as well. You normally don't get the podcasts, extra podcasts, as fast as the patrons do, but I do endeavour to put them up there as well. Right, let's crack on with the show and let's get to the meat and gravy of the situation. So should we be concerned about Aston Villa at the moment in terms of what's happening? I'm going to ask you a question, Chris Budd. You will be representing the whole of the Aston Villa fan base.
If wonderful.
If you can shoulder that burden.
I am the Jack Grealish of the fan base, you mean?
Kind of, yes.
Do I have to carry them?
Okay. So when you look at the fixtures of Manchester City, this is the run of fixtures. Manchester City, Liverpool, Wolves away, Newcastle at home, Manchester United away, Chelsea away, and then high-flying Leicester at home. How many points did you expect from that?
I would have thought maybe 4, 5. I thought we'd beat Newcastle and I felt we might get a result against United. And then I just thought, out of knowing how these things can work, I thought if you look at the other sort of 4 or 5 games, you might get a token scalp there, which obviously we didn't.
Yeah, I think maybe if you're pushing, I mean, you're saying 5 points. I would say maybe you could aim to get something at Wolves, for example. But
yeah,
if Wolves turned up, they could potentially roast us as well. So with that said, we are pretty much where we would expect before that period of games.
Yeah, you'd probably call it just about par for the course, wouldn't you?
So the problem is, though, the reality is there's that slow burn disappointment builds up when you lose. Obviously, you know, we lost against Manchester City. The way we kind of lost against Liverpool, we didn't turn up against Wolves. Newcastle game, they win, and that is the opportune moment that the board decided to give Dean Smith a new contract. This reminds me a little bit about Paul Lambert's new contract when he was spiralling, he was like a person just trying to keep his head above water. And we started off that season where I think we, did we won 3, drew one of our first 4 games? They bang slapped a new contract down. And then I don't think he won for months after that.
Sounds about right.
Hopefully, I don't want to draw a direct comparison. But yeah, that was the moment, because they would have looked at those games and thought, you know, they've obviously been in negotiations with Dean in the close season. And they're just obviously they want to see how, you know, drag it out a bit, see how he fares in the Premier League. And it's kind of all right up to this point. Not, you know, if we'd probably beaten Arsenal, beaten Spurs, he'd have probably got his new contract a bit earlier. And then you look at that running and you go, oh, shit, when are we going to give him a new contract? Beats Newcastle. There's your moment. So anyway, that's the context. When you look back in hindsight and you think, well, 4 or 5 points, that would probably be what we could expect. And that's exactly what we've got. So, I mean, we're not going to waffle on about what we need in the upcoming games. But if they spread some of those Christmas games against the bottom three in between the games we've just played, I think we would have had more points, fans would have been a bit more content, and we wouldn't be having the start of this kind of meltdown. But there is big problems, and we saw it again. One of the hot takes from the game was just the lack of threat that we have going forward. We don't have that out and out threat. Leicester come to Villa Park, and first of all, you know instantly that Vardy's a threat. You know, he's scored in X amount of games consecutively. He's done that previously when they won the league. He's a marquee headline threat. What do Villa have? They don't.
Even just in terms of like for like, you know, Wesley is not a like for like player, is he? Even like Iheanacho, he's not a like for like player with him either. Leicester just had, they have a mobile front two who are a threat. They have probably, four, five players who can win them the game.
Just in that striker position, do you think Villa would have got promoted last season if Wesley was our forward instead of Tammy Abraham?
I would.
Considering Abraham scored 26 goals.
I mean, do you know what? During that 10-game run, though, it wasn't like he was massively prolific, was it? Like, Abraham scored a lot of his goals in the first half of the season.
Yeah, which kept us there or thereabouts in terms of having a pulse, because if he didn't score those goals, I think we would have been fighting another battle.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think Wesley's he's not a 25, 30 goals a season striker at whatever level he's at. He didn't score that many in Belgium, did he?
No, I think he scrapes over double figures. But I mean, the fact is that Wesley isn't. I mean, he had 29 touches against Leicester. Vardy had 21, scored
it's
two
where,
goals.
It's where he has them, isn't it?
Exactly. And I mean, there was a situation. Spoke to you about this after the game. Off the ball, he doesn't have that striker's instinct. For example, we broke down on the right, I think it was the second half, and we had an overload of 3-on-1 with our left back, and Wesley gave the ball off, I think, to Elmo. But instead of getting in the box, because they had 2-on-1 on the flank without Wesley, so this was a chance to lay off, get in the box. He just lingered around on that right flank. And what you're going down the line, what you're ultimately trying to do is obviously create a chance to get the ball into the box. But the main striker, the lone striker, is still fanning around on the wing. He doesn't have that instinct to Abraham would have, right, I've done my job here, right, I'm in the box, I want to finish this off. And this has happened a lot of time when he comes deep to get the ball, he'll pass the ball off to Grealish or whoever who will take it on. And then he's not running alongside them. He's not, breaknecking, trying to get into the box. He stays deep.
Yeah, it's almost like having that selfish streak, isn't it? Going, I'm here to score goals and that's what I'm going to do.
And there it is. That's as good as it gets on this stage. Nissan Townstar EV strikes again. It's an unstoppable van. Unstoppable!
Look, just fantastic. You can actually see the ProPilot technology in action. Effortless parallel parking.
It moves with all the confidence that comes with a 5-year warranty.
And with a bench full of all-star van experts, there's real strength in depth here.
That's all-star quality.
Search Nissan Townstar EV and visit your local all-star van centre to see for yourself.
Terms and conditions apply. 5 years or 100,000 miles, whichever comes first.
ProPilot is an advanced driver assist technology. Driver's responsibility to stay alert, drive safely, and control vehicle at all times.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Picture the scene. All of your mates around, you've got your McNugget share boxes ready to go. Partner this with your team playing champagne football. Perfect. Order McDelivery now on the McDonald's app. There's nothing quite like a McDelivery. At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
I can't believe I'm going to compare him to someone like Codger, but you look at what Codger, he's equally, doesn't offer you a lot outside of the penalty area, but what one thing I will give him is that if you put him in and around the 18-yard box, he comes to life, doesn't he? And when he gets a chance, he's going to take a shot and he wants to get involved and score goals. Wesley just doesn't seem to get into the positions too. I mean, there was the one in the there was the El Ghazi chance, which gets pulled back. And if you watch the replay, actually it flashes past Wesley. Whereas if he puts his foot out, he probably scores.
Yeah,
he didn't gamble. No, obviously El Ghazi gets his chance, and it goes begging anyway. But it's those moments.
You mentioned Codger, but this isn't like a Codger or Wesley debate, because often or not,
neither offer enough.
Codger head down in the box, and he's not necessarily going to get a shot away because he runs constantly into traffic, and obviously teams work him out pretty quickly, especially at the Premier League level. There's a reason why he's not an established Premier League player before we picked him up, because it's not as if he's a young pup. But when you look at the overall proof, it's not a matter of just Wesley. The main thing is Dean Smith's team. And the whole ethos of Dean Smith is the much muted possession-based team. I mean, he follows Pep Guardiola's ethos. But when you break down the 16 games that we've played already, in only 3 games have we had more possession than the opposition. And that was against Newcastle, 62%, Burnley, 60.2%. And then against Bournemouth, I mean, obviously these are all home games, and against Bournemouth that only happened because we were 2-0 down very early on, and obviously Bournemouth could, you know, sit deep and just see the game out. But in Liverpool we had 26.3%.
I mean, even Everton when we won, 35, that's a home game.
Yeah, problem is, if you're playing and you're not getting as much possession, what you need is real cutting edge. You know, a lot of teams play on the counter and specialise in the counter. I mean, Leicester City, when they won the league, were a counter-attacking team. They were getting 30% of the ball, 35% of the ball. But they had, you know, they were lethal up front. They had speed, obviously, and Vardy. And when they sniffed a chance, you know, they would put it away. We don't have that same. When Villa turn up, you're hardly racking your brains, how are we going to stop this attacking threat, are you, as an opposition manager?
No, I mean, the amount of times we've surrendered under 40% of the ball is quite worrying, really. You know, it's not like we're sort of competing and getting close. It's like we're actually having dramatically less possession, which, for, as you said, for a guy who wants to set his team up to have the ball, control the game, it's something, you know, we've used that word control in probably every podcast this season. Yeah. Villa just seem to be incapable of controlling a game. Newcastle, they did, and it showed, because of how comfortable they were.
Because a lot of the time, it's because they give the ball away cheaply. I mean, you saw Grealish give the ball away. He just passed it straight to Madison, and that, you know, that ultimately resulted in one of their goals. And yeah. McGinn's been cheap. Mings has been cheap with like, casualness,
has been very
switching
casual.
Off. I mean, you look at against Arsenal, we played against 10 men for over 50 minutes and we only had 41% of possession. Against West Ham, we played 10 men at home for over 20 minutes, it was about 20 minutes. We only had 46% of the possession against West Ham at home, playing 10 men for the last 20 minutes, where you'd expect us to, you know, run them ragged, but we didn't really. And against Norwich, I think we had what you'd expect. I mean, we beat them 5-1, but we still only had 42.4% of the ball, which you'd probably
expect. It's mad, really, isn't it?
Yeah, you'd expect against Norwich.
Yeah, it shows they were very efficient that day, but that was, unfortunately, as we've seen over the course of the season, maybe that game at Carrow Road was actually a bit of an anomaly in our favour.
Yeah, but they were creating proper chances and, you know, obviously being clinical at the same time. But we haven't had that clinicalness because Wesley isn't the out-and-out striker and we're not creating chances. I can't remember him having a chance the last few games.
No, he hasn't had a shot. He hasn't really even been close to one. There was a couple of occasions in the Leicester game where you just thought, just gamble. There was one in the second half where you think, if you get in the 6-yard box and throw yourself at it, El Mohammedi put a great ball in. And he was nowhere to be seen.
So, I mean, what are our attacking threats? I mean, we've got wingers that, I mean, El Ghazi, as we saw, and this isn't the first time he's done that. I mean, he's missed gilt-edged chances. I mean, he scored some good goals. But at the same time, when we say gilt-edged chances, I mean, that was a banker, the opening goal.
Yeah, you've got to score. And that could potentially change the game. I don't personally think it necessarily would have done massively. No. I still think Leicester were a far superior team. But scoring the first goal, it suddenly changes the complexion of the game. And you're not chasing.
Especially, yeah, because the first thing Leicester want to do is get that first goal when they're away from home, because that just opens us up. And, you know, Vardy on the counter-attack, it's pretty much set up perfectly for Leicester if they're ahead. So, yeah, I mean, I think ultimately Leicester win that game if El Ghazi scores, but at least you've got a chance. And you can drop a bit deeper as well, I suppose, and not you don't have
yeah,
to force
I mean,
the game.
Yeah, Smith said sort of post-match that he thought that both managers would be disappointed at how open the first half was, especially, and that the game in general was. I mean, Leicester were wide open and Villa were, but unfortunately Leicester had the tools to kind of play through us and around us, getting behind especially, and Villa just didn't, because we didn't have willing runners.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a boxing match where the way it started is where both boxers have thrown punches, but the difference is one of them can punch like Deontay Wilder, while the other one, you know, it's powder puff stuff, and there's only one winner in that situation with it being so open.
And Leicester could control the ball. You know, the amount of times we would give the ball away in a stupid position and they would take advantage of it was just infuriating. And that's kind of becoming the theme of the season for me, unfortunately, that these we're talking about the same mistakes we were talking about in August, in December. Yeah. And at what point does that stop being, you know, sort of luck? And when does it become just ineptitude? I don't know.
Yeah, and in terms of being a just to cap off the possession, the only time I felt like we looked like a possession team was against Newcastle. That was the only game we had a reasonably comfortable control of. Everything else, I mean, and the stats are the headline here, 3 out of 16 games where we've had more possession. Admittedly, we've played a lot of the top 4 or 6 teams, but still, if you're a possession-based team, you expect more.
And then we're just so naive when we do get the ball. You know, we're not a smart team. You know, Leicester are. They're a very talented group of players, but they're very well drilled, and they know when to give away a foul. Villa give away fouls in stupid positions. Target was guilty of it. Mings was guilty of it in the first half, where he overplayed, slipped over, and just pulled the guy over on the corner of the penalty area, and he deservedly got a yellow card. I think if he hadn't got off injured, he had looked like he was playing us into trouble many times in the first half. Anyway, you know, Iheanacho and Vardy would probably be told pressure him in possession.
Yeah, well, I think Rodgers made that switch anyway to play two up top.
Yeah, just to get at Villa and press the back four.
So he'd obviously seen a weakness there.
And the big one for me was Pereira. The two fullbacks, obviously Chilwell and Pereira, are very good players. They got forward, but because Grealish is playing on essentially the left of either a midfield four or a forward three. He's going to bomb on, but he's not. It almost looked like Rodgers singled out Grealish as actually being both our strength and our weakness, in that actually, if you let Grealish go, he isn't going to get back, and Pereira could just bomb on. And every time it was Iheanacho or Pratt or Maddison and Pereira against Target, sometimes it was 2-3-on-1.
Yeah.
They clearly targeted our fullbacks. I think El Mohamedy did better than Target, but Target had a torrid time in the first half.
He was also lucky. I mean, looking at the discipline, we had 6 yellow cards. Target was very lucky to stay on the pitch.
As was McGinn.
Mings,
I mean, how we didn't get the fact that we didn't get a red card is probably the only positive you'll take from the game.
Yeah, I mean, Grealish needlessly got a 4th booking as well.
And that was stupid.
I mean, it's obviously you're feeling a bit dejected, but you've got to have that cooler mentality, especially as a captain as well, because it's the long game as well. I mean, this game was lost. You've got to think about the key games, because we looked like we picked up a few injuries as well. I mean, I don't know at this point of recording this podcast how severe Mings is and Targets, but if you're playing those 3 key games against Southampton, Watford, Norwich, and you're missing like key personnel like Mings or even Target, who, I mean, he did well early doors getting forward regardless of being ransacked defensively, but if you're going into those key games and you're missing your big men and you're not picking up the results that you should have, then it's the long game suffers big time.
Yeah, I saw a comment online that someone simply said Villa looked today like they weren't up for the fight, but they were up for a fight, which I thought was quite amusing and pretty on the money. That Villa looked very frustrated very early on. Yeah, it was a very niggly game and they weren't necessarily getting the decisions. They were obviously very aware they were making mistakes. It was a very threadbare performance. And there was one moment, I think McGinn got fouled. It was a bit of a soft one, didn't get the foul. And you can see when McGinn does this, he's almost like a slingshot. You can see him being coiled back. And just lets himself go at players. And you can see when he's going to do it. Smashed into one of their players. I think it might have been Maddison. Rightfully got a yellow card. And then 5 minutes later, gave away another silly foul and kicked the ball virtually the length of the field in frustration. I just thought, he's asking to be sent off here.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Out of sheer frustration.
But they're the victims of their own downfall most of the time. I think, in fairness, if Villa had been a bit more disciplined, we still lose the game. But you know, defensively, some of it was shocking.
The third goal is laughable, isn't it?
But the warnings were there after 3 minutes. You know, Vardy ghosts in. Nobody's marking him. Misses his chance. And I think I put a tweet out at the time. Maybe it's a good idea to mark Vardy. Because you think, you know, he's the headline marquee threat. And you think, well, somebody's got to keep an eye on him at all times. And there's been a bit of a problem with Villa's, I think the centre-backs, in terms of defending at times, they lose their man. And it doesn't take much to confuse them.
No, and you're talking about well-drilled Premier League strike forces. You know, you're not talking about like fellow newly promoted teams or like Newcastle, who showed absolutely zero willing.
Yeah, that's why Rodgers went for that 2 up top, I think, because he saw that.
He would have seen that we're actually the best way to play against Villa is to actually just go at them head first. If you sit back against Villa, you're just playing into our hands.
Yeah, I mean, when we're chasing the game, suddenly we're playing a bit too much of a high line against Vardy and we were just kind of asking for it. The thing is, you know, people said, oh, if Villa took our chances, we'd have been in the game. But, you know, Leicester had like 23 shots. And
second half, they probably had three gilt-edged chances they missed.
Heaton made some great saves. Early doors, just before Grealish's goal, Engels made a great sliding interception. I think when Vardy squared the ball, and that would have definitely been a goal, and Engels stopped that. So if it wasn't for, you know, some defensive heroics and goalkeeping heroics, that scoreline would have been up there with Southampton's, I think, when they got mauled by Leicester.
Possibly. It just looked like every time they got into the final third, especially later on in the game, they were going to hurt us. You know, once the third goal went in, it was game over. You know, in reality, I think Villa came out second half. First 5 minutes looked reasonably sharp, got into some good positions, and then the third goal just knocked the stuffing out of them completely. And it was just an appalling goal to concede. As much as it's, you know, a brilliant header from Johnny Evans, the defending is laughable.
In terms of like the team selection, Rich Clark, Matthew Facebook group said, anybody else think that it always looks a bit lacking without Connor or Hourihan? Complementing what Jack does, even when McGinn is playing well, Connor gives us another dimension. However inconsistent he is, non-existent sometimes, we miss him when he plays decent. Well, I think it's a bit of an oxymoron, that question, because if he has been pretty non-existent against Chelsea, I think, and obviously with Leicester's midfield, Smith obviously went for Nakamba and Louise, and there was a, you know, logic to that. I don't think anybody grumbled about that at the time. It allowed McGinn to go further forward. So you're expecting more from him. As we discussed in the last podcast, you know, people have been saying McGinn seems to be off the boils. And we thought, well, he's been put back in the engine room. So when I saw that team selection, I thought, oh, well, you know, let's see if McGinn actually is firing blanks, or if he is, it was just a more conservative position he was playing. But yeah, he was pretty much non-existent as well, and apart from the petulant things you've mentioned.
It was his basic things, like his first touch wasn't there. I think he got wind quite early on that he wasn't at the races, and he kind of faded, and I just thought it was one of those games where Smith needed to be a little bit more proactive earlier in the game. Unfortunately, obviously, he lost one of his substitutions in Mings going off quite early. I think you might have seen Hourihan on much earlier had he still had three substitutions on, sort of, well, once the third went in. Because I actually thought at half time we might have saved our bacon here, and we could actually, you know, get into the changing rooms, regroup slightly, and try and push on. But yet again, our second half performance is just not there.
Yep.
We're not finishing games well.
Grealish goal only gave us hope if Dean Smith at half time did some serious reconstructing and had a plan B, because when it was 2-0, we were in all kinds of trouble, but that didn't really happen. I mean, they scored a reasonably early goal in the second half, and nothing really changed, and it was game, set, and match by then.
Yeah, at 2-1, you don't necessarily have to chase quite so much, and you can kind of shut the game down and try and be a little bit more patient. But, you know, when you've got to try and chase two goals against a team like Leicester, you're just going to play into their hands, and unfortunately we played into their hands throughout the game. What was your take on, you know, obviously the sort of the press branding before the game was all about Maddison versus Grealish, you know, coming up against each other for the first time. What was your sort of take on that midfield? Because I personally thought that Grealish actually tried to carry the team too much, whereas Maddison actually completely ran the game.
Yeah, I think Maddison can blend in with his team, if that makes any sense.
Yes, where Grealish, yeah, he's part of a unit more, isn't he?
Yeah, well, Grealish kind of stands out as the beacon, and you just know you've got to take the beacon out, and that basically shuts down the rest of them.
Especially when he's on the wing, you know, when he's very much out on the left-hand side, I think it becomes a slightly easier prospect to play against rather than when he's sort of drifting around.
Yeah, but earlier on, I mean, we were talking, like, for example, on this podcast, that the good thing was that with McGinn and, you know, potentially with Louise and Nakamba stepping up, especially in the early days where you don't really know what you're getting with Louise, where he's, you know, he's coming as like this, oh, he's the guy that Pep couldn't play because he didn't have a work permit, blah, 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 and he's a genius. And you're thinking, well, Grealish is just going to be one of the lads now. He's just going to be one of the midfield. And that would benefit him because the opposition would have more things to consider. But he seems to have been pushed forward as the only hope. While Maddison is definitely a cog in the machine, and there's less emphasis on him, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. I mean, the way Leicester plays suits Maddison. You know, he's got that slightly more snap about his game than Jack. Jack sort of glides around, but he doesn't necessarily speed the tempo of the game. But Maddison gets it into feet and gets it out very, very quickly, moves the ball around.
Leicester seem to be playing, I'm trying to quantify this, but like 20 miles per hour quicker than we were.
It just suited how they play and how we play was only ever going to work for them, because they've got pace throughout the team. They were much more dynamic. We try to be sort of slightly slower and controlled and then go through the gears when we get in the final third, which we can do and have shown we can.
Yeah.
They go from back to front a lot faster. And you know, someone like Vardy, when you know you can just hit it down the channel or hit it over the top and he will chase, is such a great outlet to have away from home. Liverpool are the same. Liverpool can control a game with short passing if they want to, and then they can go long when they need to. Villa go long to Wesley and it's back to goal, but he's not going to be a willing runner in behind, and that's the big thing that's going to need to be solved for Villa.
Yeah, I mean, Manchester City have got that as well. They can do the big goalkeeper kick down the middle and away they go. Flick on.
Well, they can stretch the game quickly. You've got Sterling, Aguero's not a slouch. You've got pace and dynamism in the middle of the park. I don't think we necessarily have.
As I've maintained throughout the last few episodes regarding Grealish for England, which, you know, is big push for. But when you look at him, as I've said, I've had reservations because there's no rush is the main thing. And obviously he's got to do a thing for Villa. But there is a yin and yang to his game. I mean, for every bit of magic, there's a bit of, sin. You look at this game, he scores a great goal, but also gives the ball cheaply, you know, passes to Madison as if he's playing for England. And that leads to a Leicester goal against Manchester United, scores a wunder goal, but at the same time misses a sitter. So it's not like he's not missed 100% at the moment. And that's maybe because there's too much on his shoulders. I don't know. So
possibly, and the position he's playing in. You know, because if he's playing on the left but he wants to run the game, he's going to have to drift around. All of a sudden, if you've got a good fullback like Leicester did in Pereira, he knows he can bomb forward and Jack's not going to track him every time. All of a sudden, if you get Iheanacho or Vardy go out ride with him or Madison, your fullback has got 2-on-1 every time. And every time they had an overload in the left-back position for Villa. I thought actually Al Mohammedi dealt with Chilwell reasonably well, although that obviously the goal came from an overlap with Madison, crosses it in, actually scores, and it's a reasonably well-constructed goal. But the amount of time, it almost became predictable, and that's what was frustrating with Villa, and unfortunately with Smith on this occasion, that actually Villa not only got outplayed, they got outfought, which was frustrating, because yet again, I didn't think, similarly to United, similar to Chelsea, I don't think Leicester were a nasty team. They certainly weren't physical, fit like a big, strong physical team by Johnny Evans. But also, we saw Smith got outthought this game. We were very naive in our setup.
Leicester just had more energy and purpose and like thrust to their play. They were fast and furious. I mean, for my money, probably the most impressive team at Villa Park so far.
As an overall thing, yeah.
Yeah, Liverpool were a bit systematic. I think I was describing, you know, they were doing that diagonal ball from the edge of the 18 to the back stick all the time.
Yeah, they were more probing, weren't they? Whereas Leicester just go straight for the jugular.
They're like kind of knife through butter type, but with real intent. You thought, shit, every time they came for us, you thought, oh, here we go. The headline of the show is that Aston Villa should be concerned. I think early doors, we were getting defeats, but it was because we weren't taking chances because we haven't got that cutting edge, but we were competitive in games. And so you saw the light at the end of the tunnel. Well, I did. I thought, well, yeah, it's just a matter of time that, you know, the players are kind of gelling. We need a couple of extra elements up front to give us that kind of, you know, cutting edge. But, you know, in recent times, you know, Leicester blown away. Chelsea never really got in that game, despite the score, you know, still
being
only
one. Scoreline flattered us, really.
Yeah, scoreline flattered us. The Wolves game, we didn't even turn up. And I was hoping, you know, that Manchester United performance, I thought would give the team, you know, confidence to, maybe it gave them a bit of complacency going into the Chelsea and Leicester game. I don't know. Because confidence and complacency, you know, sometimes come hand in hand.
Yeah, they can. And I think, yeah, maybe they thought, oh, we can go to Old Trafford and get a point. Maybe not realising that the opposition they played against, same with Newcastle, really. You know, we played really well against Newcastle, really well against United. They were both on the day very poor sides. United were average. I think they had their moments. Newcastle were just dreadful. They were the, you know, if Leicester were the best team we've seen at Villa Park, I'd say Newcastle were comfortably the worst.
Yeah, I mean, United are a funny team because at the time it was like, oh, Ollie out after that result. And now it's Ollie in because he's back at the wheel, isn't he? He's beaten Manchester City away.
It kind of sums up the league, though, doesn't it? I think if you sort of take a step back from from the Villaverse, it's kind of so many teams, like the newly promoted sides have had ups and downs. I mean, who'd have thought Newcastle would go to Sheffield United and win, or nobody would have expected Norwich to beat Man City. The big thing for me is Villa haven't taken a scalp yet.
Yes.
Whereas everybody else has. We haven't yet. We've
had big opportunities. I mean, we've had gilt edge opportunities. You can't be 1-0 up against Arsenal with an extra man at half time and not take that opportunity, because other teams will.
Well, you can't even let, you know, you can't have your wobble, let them go level, then get back in front and go, right, now we've had our wobble, now we see this out. You've had your fuck up, and then they've given you another chance. It's like, oh, okay, there you go. Have it on a plate.
That's what we're saying. The lack of cutting edge and the lack of the way we play, as you say, we've got to play well as a unit to have any chance in a game.
Yeah, we still don't have that. We're not going to play badly and win.
Well, we can't steal games with a lack of possession, which we can't beat teams by being the counter-attacking force. And the problem is, 3 games out of 16, we're getting, you know, way down in the possession stakes. So how are we going to win these games? Because we haven't got that cut and thrust up front. So we've got a big problem. And I was saying, are you concerned? I was just explaining early doors. I saw the light at the end of the tunnel. But now I'm more concerned just from the way all it takes is a bit of lack of discipline. All it takes is losing a couple of key components, like Mings, for example, and then you're struggling.
If you get your yearly Grealish injury,
exactly, and then you're not picking up points against Norwich, Southampton, and Watford, because you know there's still that complacency. Right, that's where we're going to get the points, but because unfortunately all these games have been bunched together, the ones that we only expected 4 or 5 points from, that actually puts more pressure on the run of games where we've suddenly got a run of games where we're expected to get points from. So it makes it a bit more difficult. And if you're missing players or if confidence has dropped, then you've got a problem. But we haven't got that cutting edge, and that's the biggest problem of them all.
Well, it becomes very high stakes. You know, Southampton, Norwich, these will all be sold out games, big expectant crowds, and Villa are going to have to put on a show. They're going to have to go for these teams.
And the only way they're going to win with this lack of cutting edge is to dominate games. And we're struggling to have sustained pressure. We're struggling to have sustained possession as well.
And keeping clean sheets is becoming, you know, a chronic problem.
Yeah, somebody said in the Mad Few group that scoring goals wasn't a problem. It was the defence which was an issue.
I mean, I kind of agree in terms of, I think the defensive problem is, you know, if you're collectively able to hold a team at arm's length, because that's what O'Neill's teams used to be able to do very well. You know, under O'Neill, when Villa were flying high, they were not a sort of a dominant blow you away type team, although Villa, they could do that. Villa were kind of workmanlike, hold you at arm's length. The Gregory teams were the same.
We had speed and cutting edge on the counter, and we were set up as a counter-attacking team. We are not an a counter-attacking team at the moment.
Yeah, it's. I mean, people use the phrase, you know, at the start of the season, doing a Fulham. The thing why Fulham went down last season was that they were set up to dominate teams in the Championship, and most weeks they'd have 65-70% of the ball, fine. In the Premier League, they weren't set up to not have the ball. And I fear that we're probably better at not having the ball, but we're still playing well in the game and we'll still concede 2-3 goals.
Yeah.
You know, we played against a bang average United team and still conceded two. We conceded two against Burnley when we had 60-odd% of the possession. So you can't vouch for individual errors, and I don't know what you do to stop that. I know somebody in the Mad Few group commented the same thing. It's like, if it's individual errors costing us every week, how do you iron them out? Is it a mental thing? Is it an ability thing? Yeah. Is it a mixture of the two? Is it that you have to factor in the opposition's tactics more? I don't know.
But at the end, you know, at the end of the day, we've had the same amount of clean sheets as Liverpool. But it's all right scoring in every game, but you need to score more than the opposition ultimately to win a game. And we haven't got that threat. As we said at the top of the show, I don't think teams fear us coming, because it's not like we're giving them a lot of puzzles to solve to beat us. It's like, well, shut down Grealish. And what else do you need to do, really?
Earlier in the season, it was if you shut down Grealish, you're okay. And then McGinn would come to the fore, and he got us through a lot of the games. All of a sudden, McGinn's looking quite leggy and probably needs a rest. I think Smith will be glad to get this game out of the way and actually have the week with the players without, you know, a midweek match or another international break that seems to have broken up Villa's sort of progress through the first half of the season. Whether he'll look at, you know, the Liverpool game on the horizon as a chance to really get either some confidence for people or to get some game time for the overall squad and actually get everybody up to speed.
I said I'm starting to feel a little bit more concerned because of this lack of potency. How are you feeling in a nutshell? Do you share the same fears?
I'm sort of cautiously optimistic we'll get it right, and I think we've seen enough that we can hurt teams. My big sort of theme of the whole season has been this consistent. It's the same errors in the same manner. Yeah. Most games, even the games against like Newcastle, games we've won, even the bloody Norwich game, we conceded an absolute howler of a shoot yourself in the foot goal. So even when we're winning games, we're making stupid individual errors. I'd love to see a game when we actually show a little bit of killer instinct, even if we don't blow a team away, but actually show some control at the back. I'm not necessarily concerned yet, but there are certain questions that are yet to be answered. So it's not like panic stations just yet. I think if we were to have, say, a bad Christmas period, if Southampton came to Villa Park and won and Norwich came to Villa Park and won, I think the atmosphere would change quite quickly.
We would be rooted in the bottom three, seriously, then, if those results happen.
Yeah, whereas I think most people take the run of games we've had into their thoughts and go, okay, well, do you know what? We've got, as long as we win the games we should be winning, we're okay.
Yeah, I think the bottom line is not to be cut adrift entering 2020.
No, which I don't actually think we will. I think it's so bloody competitive. I look at everybody in the bottom 10 and think it's much of a muchness, really.
Yeah, Dean Smith has to find a way to get Wesley in the danger zone. And also, they do need to bring in some sharpeners in the January window. And a player that would, you know, for example, if you got another striker, they'd have to hit the ground running. It's not like, well, there's that player who's young, who's not getting games.
Who might come good in a year's time. We don't need that now.
And he's not getting in the Leicester team or the Liverpool team at the moment. So it's kind of, we need almost like a guaranteed surefire option.
Yeah, you look at like when, you know, Sunderland were in trouble and they went and got Jermaine Defoe and he pretty much kept them up. You're looking at that kind of player, which unfortunately, having seen Smith's and Purslow's kind of thoughts on transfer policy, I don't know if they're going to go that way. Maybe even if they necessarily think, well, this is what we need in the short term, I don't know if they're going to make short-term decisions.
Right, anyway, let's get out of here. We have rambled on perhaps a little long on this. Next up is obviously Sheffield United, who baptised us twice in the Championship last season. We managed to get out of jail in the last game at Villa Park, but be interesting to see how they respond to the Leicester game, because I'm sure Sheffield United will come for our throats. Before we go, any advice to people having meltdowns on social media?
Let's just enjoy Christmas. Just enjoy your Christmas and let's see where we are in January.
Yeah, I mean, before anybody gets the pitchforks out, as we said at the top, we'd have been happy with 4 or 5 points from that run of games that we've just had.
I mean, if you reversed some of the results, if we'd have only lost 2-1 to Leicester but lost 4-1 at home to Liverpool, I don't think anybody would have batted an eyelid.
Yeah, or even 4-1 away at Chelsea, which could have easily have happened.
Yeah, or City or wherever.
You know, straight after games, when you've been beaten 4-1 by anybody, everybody's
a bit pissed
off. I
think it's just the manner, isn't it? It's definitely the manner that's pissing the fans off, not necessarily where we are in the table.
But also, we've been through this massive hype cycle as well, so it is a bit of a drop when reality kicks in. I mean, a lot of fans said, well, as long as we finish 17th, which, you know, it's fair comment at the start of the season, but the way everybody's hyped, it's like you have a feeling that you're supporting team that's going to finish in the top six or whatever. And when reality does kick in, finishing 17th is essentially a relegation battle all the way through the season. And this is what we are now entering. I thought, you know, from the competitiveness earlier on, that if we had a bit more cutting edge, I think we would have been mid-table. You only have to look at the likes of what Sheffield United have done, and, you know, Wolves did last season.
There's a lot of very average sides.
Yeah, Burnley have, you know, they've got their big men they put on, as we witnessed when they came to Villa Park. They've got a weapon, they've got something they can use.
Well, they play to their strengths, Villa don't.
Yeah, exactly. We don't know what our strengths are at the moment, because we're meant to be a possession-based team, but as we have said, we don't have possession in most of these games at Premier League, because it's a different level from the Championship. But anyway, on that note, we will see what the rest of December brings to us in the next few podcasts, and I'm sure at the end of the year we'll be able to have a better insight into how final months of the season will pan out and what our destiny more than likely will be. Right, until next time, it's goodbye from me, and it's goodbye from him.
Goodbye.
away days are great, but there's nothing quite like playing at home. The same goes for McDonald's. Maximize your home ground advantage with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app. At participating restaurants, 18 plus serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
And there it is. That's as good as it gets on this stage. Nissan Townstar EV strikes again. It's an unstoppable van. Unstoppable!
Look, just fantastic. You can actually see the ProPilot technology in action. Effortless parallel parking.
It moves with all the confidence that comes with a 5-year warranty.
And with a bench full of all-star van experts, there's real strength in depth here.
That's all-star quality.
Search Nissan Townstar EV and visit your local all-star van centre to see for yourself.
Terms and conditions apply. 5 years or 100,000 miles, whichever comes first.
ProPilot is an advanced driver assist technology. Driver's responsibility to stay alert, drive safely, and control vehicle at all times.
This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.